Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 28th, 2016, and welcome to episode 121 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and profit. Welcome to the end of February, Leap Day Eve. With me, I'm Paul Hegstrom, and I'm joined today by Michael Mulhern in Australia. How are you?
I'm fine.
Excellent. And Jack Nutting in Sweden. And how are you?
I have a bit of a cold, honestly. Apart from that, pretty good. But you may hear some coughing and sneezing and other weird sounds. Don't be alarmed. Just a normal cold.
I can't wait.
I know it's not swine flu because I already had that once. So I've been sort of pre-disastered.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm just going to put a virus filter on my computer.
That's right. Well, okay. So we failed to come up with anything that actually tied in with Leap Day Eve. So instead, what we will do for the host's topic today is talk about becoming rich with retro computers. And what I mean on that is, what was your first program that you got paid to write, you know, back when the retro computers were just computers? Most of us, I think, have at least gone on to, you know, some kind of computer programming future from there. And that was the time when it was just beginning to become possible to actually get paid to do this stuff without not just sitting in, you know, at home playing around. So I think all of us probably have had some experience in that domain. So who wants to start? Let's see. Michael, how did you start becoming rich?
Oh, well, I must have missed the rich part, but when I started university back a long time ago when I was only 16, I found the computers up in the School of Science and ended up teaching myself and enjoyed it so much that one of the lecturers came and saw me and asked if I'd be interested in writing support programs for tutorial groups used by other lecturers. And the first one I wrote was actually for running in a kiosk-like setup in an Apple II for an open day, and it was for the School of Environmental Studies. And what they wanted was a illustration of ecosystem interactions, and they gave me some notes from like a year 11, year 12 biology, because they wanted to relate it to the kids coming in to look at what the university was offering. And it was basically creatures in a pond, so you had various from algae, plankton, predator, fishes and whatnot, and you had to basically work out the hierarchy of the fictitious fish and other things in the pond. So that was using graphics, a little bit of animation. It was all written in AppleSoft Basic with graphic extensions to a commercial graphics package. And funnily enough, it was only earlier this year that I found the 5 1/4-inch floppy disk that had my copy of that on it, along with a couple of other tutorial demonstration packages that I wrote. So, yeah, it brought back memories of my first endeavors into, I suppose, contract programming. I seem to remember that I got a couple of $100 for the four programs that I wrote, so not too bad. It certainly was more interesting than attending lectures. And from that, I suppose, that was the start of the slippery slope of actually ending up in a IT-based career. So it might not have made me rich, but it has certainly allowed me to make a living.
Excellent, excellent. Jack, how about you? What was your first paid gig?
Well, I think if I'm going to stretch the definition of writing software to include making DOS batch files, can I make that stretch? Because then I can go farther back.
Sure.
Then I'm going to say my first thing where I got paid to write software was, this must have been about 1987 or maybe even 6, I'm not sure. There was a guy in the small town where I lived who owned a bookstore. It was like a bookstore and a card shop that was sort of, I think it was vaguely Christian themed, if I remember. And my girlfriend at the time, she had a job working there. And so this guy got to know that I was good with computers. And he said, oh, hey, I've got this thing I want to do. He had some sort of PC. It may have even been an IBM, I'm not sure what it was. He had some kind of PC, and he had some kind of Bible software, like where you could like look up Bible verses and things, and he wanted me to, like, step one was actually just install it, because he was not good with computers at all, so he didn't even have it actually up and running and working. And then he wanted me to sort of customize something about the environment, and like he wanted to be able to sort of like use this to run some sort of like Bible study courses in his home or something, and like be able to use the computer as a tool to look up whatever. I didn't really understand, but I did something. I did something for him with the computer, and it's all very vague. It's so long, I don't remember. But I did something that helped him in some way with this thing, and he paid me some amount of money. I think I might have got like $75 or something. Which,
wow.
Seemed very good for whatever little I did, because whatever I did, it was really so little that I don't even remember what it was. But he seemed happy, so. And that's how I started becoming a consultant.
Very cool.
Doing things you don't understand for someone who understands it even less.
Yeah.
The virtues of being vague.
Yeah, let's see. I mean, I guess I, for me, when I was starting, you know, I basically this was in school and just in, I guess this is junior high or something, just messing around in the computers there. And there was, for me, there was a teacher there who was working with, I think, the special education program or something. And he had this evaluation test that I think he was, a friend of his had written or something as part of her doctoral dissertation. And so I was tasked with putting together this the Minnesota Concise Assessment Score Processor. I just booted up the program on my screen, and it says program copyright 1985 by me and this guy. So very cool. So I actually, you know, got a chance to put together a nice little AppleSoft based program that would ask questions and rate, you know, give you some sort of diagnosis, I guess. But yeah, I think that was probably the first thing, and I don't remember what I got for it, but I got something for it. But what I mainly remember was after that, you know, probably I think coming out of eighth grade or something, I got hired at this hotel in the town, and I'm pretty sure at this point that the reason I got hired was because kids are super cheap, like money seems like. Like a little bit of money to them seems like a lot. So I think I did kind of a lot of work for not very much money early on. But
cool.
But yeah. So I don't know. I think, you know, my memories are also pretty vague of that point. But it was still, you know, it was so much better than washing dishes or, you know, delivering papers or whatever. So.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I found is doing it. I was sort of enjoying it so much, and it was sort of, and they want to pay me to do this?
Yeah.
So, Yeah. The other program that was on the disc might actually even still have relevance in today. It was for a I suppose political science. It was a interactive gerrymander program. Mm-hmm. So you had a grid on the screen of voting intentions for Party A and Party B, and then you had a series of three challenges to actually make a number of electorates be designed through this grid so that to elect a particular party. And it was quite a fun exercise in plotting the path through the grid and then running the counts through there. And quite a lot of fun sort of coming up with the algorithms to actually track through and make sure that I didn't miss any of the voters, because you wouldn't want to gerrymander and sort of miscounting somebody to throw out the election, would you?
Cool.
No hanging chads in my programs.
Yeah, we're in the US, we're gearing up for another election, of course, and
well, it's too late to be rigging the electoral boundaries now. It needs to all be set in place.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have acquired now, I think I have two copies now of the strategic software. What is it called? Interactive SSI. The game company SSI. They have a program called
President
Elect. Exactly. Yeah,
I've got that. I loved playing that one when I bought it. It was actually one of the first games I bought, rather than non-residential archival backups.
Yeah, I was actually hoping later on this year I can plug in the numbers and see, you know, see what it says. But yeah, on the back it says, you know, it's like who's going to be next after Reagan or whatever. It's very nice.
Yeah, what they re-released that later on just to update the candidates, didn't they? I'm trying to remember if mine was 84.
Yeah, I think there was an 8. I had thought there was an 81 one and an 88 one, but maybe it was 84 and 88. But anyway, yeah, I have two of them, but they're both 88. And anyway, yes.
And I didn't write it, and I didn't make any money out of that one, but
but still. So I think I may be the only one of us on this whole podcast that really ended up not winding up in tech. You know, so I like teach at university, don't do anything computer related really. Except, you know, sit in a huge forest of old computers, but still I do feel like, you know, it nevertheless kind of set the path. I mean, like, I'm sure I would have done something just entirely different. I think what I ended up doing academically was kind of motivated initially by trying to figure out, how to make computers like talk. And it just wound up sort of like looking at the academic part of that more than the computer part after I actually got to grad school. But, so... Anyway, so we can move on from that. We had a bit of listener feedback that, once again, we haven't really fully compiled properly. So I think we'll mostly leave that for next time. But there is one thing that we made it into the show notes, which is Matt Lacey wrote about, this is a Stack Exchange, a retro computing Stack Exchange site. I don't know, what do you call these things? That's a question and answer spot. And this has been proposed, a retro computing site has been proposed, and it has gotten past the initial stage. I forget what the initial stage is called, but enough people thought this would be an interesting thing that it has made it into the next stage, which is the commitment stage. So what they're looking for now is basically people to commit to being active participants on this site. So, and I'm sure people have seen, you know, various Stack Exchange sites for other things, and it is a nice sort of resource for if you have a question. I mean, half the time I have a Ruby question or something, it's, you know, that's where I land. So I think it would be quite useful for retro computing, but anyway, it's at 45% commitment, and I think there's some kind of algorithm that goes into, like, if you commit, it takes into account sort of how active you've been on other Stack Exchange sites and so forth. So I have not myself been active enough to bump the number very much, but I am committed to helping it once it starts. So take a look at that. We will have a link to this in the show notes. Has anyone else had much chance to look through this?
I have not yet.
I've had a quick look at it, but it's Stack Exchange is not something which I normally go to, so I suppose it's something which I should actually put up on my bookmarks bar and maybe get in there and try and answer some of these questions and just sort of see where it goes from there. But it seems to be a great idea, and if it is a tool that people are used to using, then it'd be great to have a retro computing space in it.
Yep. Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think, like you said, Paul, I very often end up on Stack Overflow finding answers for things, and sometimes I even get on there just to surfing around looking for things that I can answer on some of the iOS development stuff. But yeah, I think this would actually be a great thing for retro computing. I think they have a really good the platform that Stack Exchange offers is very, it's very nice. It's very advantageous to the traditional web forum or mailing list format. So I think it's a great idea. I'm going to commit to this.
Hooray. Yeah, I'm curious to see where it goes. I mean, the advantage to it is, you know, the sort of persistence, and you know, if there are, and you can rate other people's answers and things like that, and so it is a little bit better suited to this than a forum. It's way better suited to this kind of stuff than Facebook. I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on, at least on the Apple II site on Facebook, but it all falls off the end within 2 days. And so people keep asking the same thing over and over again. And, yeah, anyway, so, I intend to sort of like for a while anyway, go in here and see if there are things I can answer or, opine on or whatever. Anyway, looking forward to see how that progresses. And the rest of the feedback that we got, thank you for sending it. We will address it next time. So now we can move on to... Oh, well, actually, yeah, I was going to say we can move on to the items of interested news, wherein Jack will start with something sent in listener feedback.
Yeah, so the very first news item here actually was sent in today, hot off the presses, by a listener... I'm going to get this wrong. Mishai. I'm guessing. Sorry, Mishai, I'm missaying your name. Anyway, this is about the Bonami Speel Computer Museum in the Netherlands, which I'd never heard of before. And me being in Sweden, this is not that far away. This gives me one more reason to want to visit the Netherlands. It seems like it's a very cool thing. It's housed in a big warehouse, and basically you pay your 12 euros to get in, or whatever the cost is, and you can play all the games they have all day long. They have a bunch of arcade games, and they have shelves and shelves full of old computers and game consoles and all sorts of stuff. Now, the website is all in Dutch, but there are lots of nice pictures, and Google translates it more or less well enough for me to read it. So
yeah, I was going to say that Google Translate does a reasonable job of it. That's actually quite an interesting site, the museum.
Yep, and even if you don't have time to go to the Netherlands and check it out, they have a lot of nice pictures and things to look at, and it looks pretty sweet.
Cool. Michael, you have a sort of a depressing story, but maybe not.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it is a bit of a depressing story. Dick Smith Electronics here in Australia is in its final throw, so it's set to close. So Dick Smith was originally founded back in 1968, so it's electronic components, kits, and originally catered for the ham radio community. And it was, I say, very important in my younger days, more so for my brother, because he was more into building bits and pieces from scratch. But I quite enjoyed going along to our local Dick Smith store just to see what was there. And in later years, actually, Dick Smith used to have quite a good range of software, and is where I picked up my first Linux distribution. I think it was Mandrake. I think that was based off the Red Hat, but that was quite a while ago. So not only did it sort of get me interested in electronics and kits and computers, and Dick Smith basically sold commercial computers early on, and then moved into selling their own branded ones. So, you know, they had the System 80, which was a TRS-80 Model 1, The Dick Smith Cat, which was an Apple clone, and then they had the VZ200 and 300, little Z80 machines. I've got a couple of each of those. Like to get my hands on a System 80 and a Cat, and then there was also a somewhat less than stellar, the Super 80 kit computer, which they did as a project with the Electronics Australia magazine. So, you know, the magazine came out monthly and you progressively built yourself a woefully underpowered computer. But it would have been a good exercise. I vaguely remember that being in the Electronics Australia magazines. I used to read them out of the library. I never actually got that one myself. But, yeah, in 1980, it was sold to Woolworths and for 60%, and then the balance in 82 for a total of $25 million. And that's where I think the Dick Smith stopped being really the Dick Smith that I liked. They basically became a box reseller, just like another TV, audio, computer reseller that you would find anywhere on this planet. And no, they got into trouble in 2012, closed stores, sold off stuff, and then sold to Anchorage Capital Partners for a deal of between $80 and $100 million. And then 18 months later, Anchorage floated it with a market capitalization of $520 million. And if they weren't already on the slide then, that basically was the last set of nails in the coffin. And, you know, they just lost what differentiated themselves from the other stores out there in the Australian marketplace. As I said, they just became another electronics, TV, audio reseller that was out there, and their prices were not that spectacular. Their own brand stuff wasn't that exciting, and really, although it's in its last few weeks now as they're closing stores and laying off staff and selling off the stock, at there's nothing there that I want to buy. And really, as I said, it was the 80s was when, you know, it stopped being one of my favorite places. So, you know, it's a sad day in Australian retail space, and you know, I remember them fondly for their retro computers and how they got me started into, you know, playing with electronics. No, I'm not as great with it as a lot of other people, but you know, I learnt my soldering skills and whatnot from kits that I bought from there. So yeah, so sad day, but it was inevitable. So I'll chuck in a couple of links so that our overseas listeners can find out a bit more about Dick Smith. But really, it's pretty much like how Radio Shack went. They lost their way and basically were just another retail space out there.
Yeah, it does sound like you know, more or less the same story as Radio Shack. But
yeah, all I can say is at least they didn't really turn into a mobile phone reseller.
Right. And Atari, and yeah, there's a lot of companies that kind of transformed into something else that you don't care about so much when they disappear.
Yeah, so, you know, it's an old story, insert name here, but yeah, sad nonetheless.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. So I have the next one. And so what I wanted to mention was that there is another podcast to listen to, in case you are running out of podcasts to listen to, if you have exhausted the antics. There is a new podcast called TRS-80 Trash Talk, and this is Peter. Oh, see, now I don't know how to pronounce his name. probably you can hear all of these people's names pronounced on the podcast. I have listened to it, but I've then, you know, forgotten. So let's just say Peter Satinsky, Randy Kindig, and Ian Maverick are the trash talkers. But so this is, it's focusing on the TRS-80 computers, primarily not the Coco, but the you know, like the Model 1, Model 3, Model 4, some on the Model 100 and 102 and so forth. So take a listen to that. I listened to the first one. I think there's only one out so far. And one of the co-hosts is the person who is responsible, I think, for building and distributing the FRED, which has gotten some mention earlier. It's the hard drive, the compact flash hard drive emulator for a lot of these computers, like the model. It works on the Model 1, the 3, and the variants of the 4. And I've been sort of very interested to get one of these all the way up until I heard this episode, where actually one of the things they were announcing was the, and I'm not sure even what they're calling it, but the M3SE project by Peter Bartlett, which is a little device. It also plugs into these, you know, the same type of TRS-80s, and it's expensive. It's $300 on eBay, or you can get it for $275 directly from their site. But it is just something. So I kind of wanted to at least talk about this, just because I have never seen such a comprehensive device. It's really, part of the problem is that I don't think I may well not get a FRED now. If I get one of these things, this might be it. So this has a compact flash, hard drive emulator. It has Ethernet connection. It has real-time clock. It has SVGA output and a joystick port for Atari Commodore type joysticks. And there is a EEPROM on it for persistent storage. And it's just, that's just amazing, you know. So it's got everything all in this one little board. I think it might be slightly too big to actually fit inside like a 4P, but it just comes as a little board. But man, first of all, I want one of these, and second of all, I want one of these for all of my computers, like other things apart from the TRS-80 as well.
Yeah, it says here minimum system requirements is a TRS-80 model 4, 4D or 4P,
the M3SE. By the way, there's a Mize. So the on the trash, whatever it is, trash talk podcast, they did kind of go over this in more detail. So
I must have missed that bit, but
for what the Mize was, which is the one for the Model 1, and this M3SE, which is a follow up. But it says add on device for Model 3, Model 4, 4D, and 4P. So it should work. Should work on the 3, and if you have a 1, then you can use the Mize, which is actually a little bit more expensive, but I think has a lot of the same stuff.
Mm. Yeah, but as far as a interface to the modern world for a retro computer, it has superb specifications. I love how it has the SVGA display output.
Yeah, it's something. When I looked at I watched a couple of the demo videos, and it looks like I think maybe on the threes and the fours, it's not mirroring. It's actually just sort of like a second display or something like that. But I think on the Model 1, it actually is just mirroring the display. So kind of strange.
Well, I could live with that.
There's a bunch of photographs showing a TRS-80 and a secondary screen next to it with different output on the two screens. Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's definitely a secondary display, which it doesn't seem like if that machine is not built for that from the beginning. I wonder how in the world it deals with that internally, of having a concept of being able to output different things on different displays. But clearly it does. So
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, I have a 4. What do I have? 4P. And I think I will have to. I've been sort of like debating getting a FRED forever, ever since I'd heard about it a couple of years ago. But now I have a new thing to debate. So, I've never seen so many things in one device. It's just amazing. So, anyway.
Yeah, I suppose when you add up all of the functionality, $275 to $300 is not really that much, after all.
No. No, I mean, you know, it's still probably more than the Model 4 you got to plug it into cost, but yeah.
No, I don't know. I just went and spent $75-$80 for just a VGA adapter for my 2C. I've gone and got other bits and pieces for, you know, $100 to $150 for other computers. So really, I think from a individual functionality, $275 to $300 is actually coming out quite cheap.
Yeah.
But still, it's a big hit for a single purchase, you know, as opposed to, you know, $50 here, $100 there. You know, you're looking at shelling out $300 for a single transaction. But boy, what you get with it is amazing.
Yeah.
And as far as the Trash Talk podcast go, I thoroughly enjoyed it, the first episode. So, it's good to hear a podcast out there for yet another one of the retro computers. It's excellent that some people are spending the time to give us the detailed information about another one of the famous computers of the day.
Yeah, I really like listening to it because this is an area that I don't know very much about. You know, I have gotten a couple of machines in preparation for learning something about them, but that's as far as I got, you know, so... So I am sort of looking forward to hearing about the expansion options and things like that. And I got just recently I got another disk video interface for the Model 100. I think that got mentioned, you know, several episodes ago when I got the first one. I now have two. But the so what it is, it's supposed to be basically like a floppy disk, floppy disk and video output for this Model 100. So the Model 100 is that little portable thing with the LCD display. And so the problem with the first one that I got was that there's this cable you need, and it's apparently a very complicated cable to build, and I didn't have the cable. And I lucked into another one that got listed recently, and it had the cable, so I jumped on that. And I had a chance to test it out, and pretty cool. So the one that it works, and that also is sort of like, it's a little bit like it's another computer that you control from the Model 100 in a way. I'm not exactly sure what's in there, but that has the same kind of feel of like switching to a second screen. I mean, like you start typing on the Model 100 and you say, like, I think it's like screen 1-1 or something like that, and then it will switch to displaying on the output of the other thing. And then you type there, and when you want to go back, you type screen 00 or 01 or something. I followed the manual and it worked. So I'm not sure exactly what to do beyond that, because it doesn't seem like it seems like the programs are going to have to be specifically written to use this thing. So it may be only my own programs that will benefit from this. But anyway, that was interesting, and I'm hoping that I can hear from the Trash Talk podcast more about what I can do with these things. Okay. Anyway.
Cool.
Michael is listed again.
Yes.
Somehow.
Yes. This is a little bit of television viewing. The show is called The Conversation with Alex Malley. It's an Australian show. He's a CEO of CPA Australia. But this episode, he was interviewing Nolan Bushnell. Now, I had great expectations for this half hour episode. I'll include a link to the website, and at the moment, as of Sunday, the interview itself isn't yet available. It says that it'll be available from the Monday after. But really, it just came down to the usual questions, a bit of family history, Steve and Chuck E. Cheese, and some of what you're doing now. And, of course, the $50,000 offer that he turned down. That offer being the opportunity to get on the ground floor of a small company called Apple. Now, all he had to do was front up $50,000, and he too could have become... a computing god. Oh, that's right, he already was. and then they got chatting on what he's doing now, and one of the things that they covered was a new project he's involved in called Brain Rush. So I'll include a link to that, but that seems to be more of a teaching tools, software things for teachers to include into their programs. But really, nothing really new came up in the episode that a lot of us didn't already know, but I suppose it was good from the perspective that it was presenting Nolan Bushnell to a new generation of people who might have only just been aware of him and Atari and things that went on. So he covered entrepreneurship, trials and tribulations of working at Atari and its selling it to Warner. It was, I suppose, a good light interview. Nothing heavy, nothing new. But I'll include the link, and you can make up your own minds about it.
Yeah, I know that Nolan has been working on this Brain Rush thing for a while. When I met him in 2010, I think, or maybe even 9, and he was talking about it then already. So this is something that's, it's been ongoing. But it seems like it has not really taken off yet. I think the idea is a bit like, they're trying to sort of gamify education, sort of. A bit like kind of Duolingo for learning languages, but for more things than just languages. So like being able to sort of make software that is engaging and helps people learn things by giving them, you know, incremental rewards in the style of, say, Candy Crush. But you're learning something instead of just playing Candy Crush. So
maybe you can, like, as an in-app purchase, you know, buy an A.
Maybe buy an A as the letter A or the grade A?
I was thinking the grade, but...
I was thinking Wheel of Fortune style, buy a vowel.
Right.
Yeah. I have enough app points to buy myself a A+.
And speaking of A+, I don't know, maybe that's not such a great segue, but Jack, you have something.
Yes, this is not strictly retro news, but I know that a lot of people in this world are also interested in the Raspberry Pi. We talk about it every single show, I think. And one of the problems with the Raspberry Pi has been there has not been onboard wireless connectivity. But it looks like some documents have surfaced, FCC documents that need to be filed by anybody who wants to make electronics for sale in the U.S. in certain situations, showing the Raspberry Pi 3 with onboard Wi-Fi and Bluetooth.
Hurrah!
Which seems pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So, I'd much rather have a Pi with Wi-Fi than without.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it does sort of depend on, like, if it's, like, to what extent it's going to make everything more expensive, but
right.
Well, it'd be convenient. I've just gone and purchased, I'm waiting to arrive. I bought 4 little USB Wi-Fi adapters, so I can just plug them into Raspberry Pis. But again, that'll take up a USB port unless I go and put a hub on it. So yeah, it's more bits and pieces hanging off, but it would be nice to have Wi-Fi and Bluetooth built in, especially if you're going to be using it as a the major component of an interface. If you're wanting to do any work with it, you need to plug back into it. With this, theoretically, you'll be able to get to it a little bit easier.
Yep.
Or at least one less set of wires to plug in.
Yeah, I got one of those, one of Charles Mangan's little 2Cs that has a space in it for Raspberry Pi A+. But of course I had, I basically had to get all the pieces. And so I just recently got a bunch of those little USB, Wi-Fi adapters after, it turned out I had a couple such things lying around, but the drivers don't exist. And, it's not as easy as it should be. So at least these will be built in.
I specifically tracked down some that, are supposedly for the Raspberry Pi, so we'll see if I've gone and done my $10.
Yeah, well, good luck. Yeah, I've been watching the Micro Center, this big computer retailer store, and they right around Christmas when the Raspberry Pi Zero came out, they had a few of them and they sold out. I think the same day. I mean, and you could only get it, I think it was one per household, and you couldn't get them online, you just had to go in. But so I think maybe a week and a half ago or something, I just happened to pull up the Micro Center site, and it said 10 available. And so this was like 10 in the morning, and so I said, oh, well, great, I will go get one. And I got there like 3 in the afternoon, and they're all gone. So, yeah.
I thought you were going to say you got there at 10:15 and in the morning, and they were all gone.
What was quite it was sort of annoying was that the website said as I departed, it said one left. That was kind of what's motivated me to get out the door.
Okay.
You know, it's like goodness, all right, well, I will just go now. I will not wait till tomorrow. And I got there, and I looked around. I didn't see it. Didn't see anything anywhere. Eventually, I went up and asked somebody, and they were consulting about this with some other people. And then somebody else came up with his son, and apparently, you know, he said, "Are you looking for the Raspberry Pi 02?" And apparently, so they had also seen this like one left designation and driven from like a neighboring city to try to come get this thing. And apparently, the one that they had left was. It was fake, you know, it was like, I think it was defective or something, or there was something that they couldn't actually sell. So I had a chance to talk to a guy about, like, he was trying to get his son into programming. Ultimately, I don't think that the Raspberry Pi Zero was the right thing for that, because he wanted the kid to learn how to, like, manipulate registers and stuff like that, and I'm telling him, you know, it's a Linux box. It's not going to be, you know...
But, it's just another PC.
Yeah.
It's very small.
So perhaps he managed to switch over to something like Arduino or Propeller or something. I don't know. But I didn't see how that story ended, but it was still sort of amusing just how unprepared Micro Center was for the speed with which these things vanished again.
The onslaught.
Did you have something else you wanted to say on that?
No, I was just gonna say. In all honesty, I just want a Raspberry Pi Zero just so I can sort of have one.
Oh yeah, I know. Like I have. Yeah, like,
just because.
Yeah, I'll probably end up doing all the development work on the other Raspberry Pis, but just have a Zero to see if I can slip it inside one of my retro computers, or like hide the real world interface, and then just say make a breakout box.
Yeah, I would like to do that with. At least some of these things, and maybe the Raspberry Pi Zero is the best one because it's small. Although the A Plus is pretty small too, but and then you really do want to have some sort of Wi-Fi connectivity. I was thinking I was going to try to do this. Maybe I said this before, but I was going to try to do something like this in the Apple III. I have a CF card in there with a SD Wi-Fi SD card inside an adapter inside the card, but. It occurs to me that that may not actually work because the Apple III was specifically designed to be this like completely shielded thing. So I think Wi-Fi signals may not get out. It might be sort of like putting it inside like an Atari 800. But anyway, okay, let's see. I have the next thing, and the next thing is there was an announcement that the Bug Book Museum. Is moving to the Computer Museum of America. So this is David Larson's collection of old, like, vintage computers and stuff that he has decided he's going to donate to the Computer Museum of America, which is Lonnie Mim's collection. So this is the collection that was sort of featured at least as part of the VCF Southeast exhibit for the last couple of years, and so Lonnie Mims is a huge collection of things, and so David Larson was delivering these things to the Computer Museum of America so that at least they're sort of being moved when the stories behind the things are still available, right? So there's a little article about just bringing this stuff over and some videos, and one of the things there was a video of him delivering his Apple I, the John Birch Apple I, to the Computer Museum of America, and... that actually got me traveling down some side roads on YouTube, and I found a pretty interesting video. It's a 1996 video selling my Apple I computer. So somebody had an Apple I, and they were selling it. I don't actually know what it sold for, but let's see. I did this video in 1996 to show a collector in California the finer points of my Apple I that I was trying to sell. He bought it and later sold it on eBay. It then sold at Christie's in London and was the first Apple I to sell for six figures. So this is a well-traveled Apple I. But what I thought was kind of interesting about it was that it's actually in the box. So I'd seen the white Apple I boxes, and I've seen the Apple I boards, but I hadn't seen like the foam with the cutouts for the capacitors and stuff. I don't know if you had seen this video that I linked to, but it's got, you know, it's a white box with the kind of the same foam that you would see in like an Apple II box, but the Apple I board has these three huge capacitors on it. You know, that's the kind of the thing that makes it identifiably an Apple I board, and there's little cutouts in the foam specifically to like make space for those. And I don't know, it was interesting to see, and I had never seen a picture of that before. So link to that. And I also noted that the video is half as old as the Apple I itself. So this was shot in 1996 and the Apple I was 1976. So anyway, let's see what else. I think there was another thing. Oh yeah. Related to this, the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast has been announced. It is April 2nd to 3rd, and that is again being held basically right there where the Computer Museum of America is, so in Roswell, Georgia. Jerry Manock is one of the speakers, Apple Industrial Design, and Bill Hurd from Commodore, and many exhibits and all sorts of podcasters and all kinds of fun stuff to do, so check that out if you're anywhere near there.
If I were anywhere near there, I would check it out.
as you should. Excellent. I guess, I don't know, this is a very loosely arranged bunch of topics here, but speaking of VCF in general, the Vintage Computer Forum that we have long announced in the outro of our shows has moved. So the link that we used to provide no longer works. And everything is basically under the Vintage Computer Forum itself has become sort of hosted as part of the Vintage Computer Federation, you know, the VCF parent organization. And so the new forum site is vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. And I guess I'll be saying that in the outro now, but you need to have you need all those parts. You can't leave off the PHP. You can't leave off the forum. Maybe someday there'll be a nice, like, quick link version for that. But at any rate, if you wanted to complain about the podcast and you couldn't find the forum to do it in, that's how you get there. So
wonderful.
I think we'll just update the link on our webpage, and that might just be the easier way to get there.
We could also just tell them to go to vcfed.org and click the forum link.
We could. Many, many options.
They could go to Google and type in.
No. I've actually seen ads on TV where they say type whatever in Google.
What's the AOL keyword for the Vintage Computer Forum?
Right. Okay. So now, a word from our sponsor.
It's a Radio Shack Merry Christmas. This Christmas, Radio Shack's best-selling portable computer, the Tandy 102, is a better gift than ever. It has 5 built-in programs, and now it's slimmer and lighter and on sale for only $399. Save $100. So when you give the Tandy 102, you've got Christmas in the desk, in the briefcase, or in the bag. Tandy Portable Computer, sale priced from $399, only at Radio Shack.
And we are back. In keeping with the various themes of today, the retro computing gift idea that I have picked is, now what is he calling it? I think he's calling it a cuboid, but it's a next cube shaped Raspberry Pi 2 case. And this is Adam Summerfield. He's actually also the one who was behind, he was working with Charles Mangan on the Lisa, the little Lisa cases for the Raspberry Pi. This is a next cube case. It is little 3D printed thing painted black. It is probably its footprint is the same size as a Raspberry Pi 2, and its height, being a cube, is also about the same size as a Raspberry Pi 2, so that there must be a lot of space in there. But
yeah, I was looking at it and sort of thinking, sort of, oh, I wonder if there's it's like freeform mounting points in there. I could fit in an SSD with a USB adapter. Put my Wi-Fi in there. No, power supply.
Right. Yeah, or
it
batteries.
Could fit quite a
yeah.
bit in there, but yeah.
Yeah, there's no picture of the thing open, so it's hard to know, or it's impossible to know. Yeah, but it would be nice to know.
Yeah, there are in the Facebook Next group. He's been posting you know, some of the development stuff as he's been working through this. And so I don't know actually if the 3D models, he's shown pictures of his, you know, the 3D modeling software, but I don't know if the actual models are available. And you know, even there, that I don't think I've seen inside it. So, many of the same views actually, but it looks nice. I mean, you know, the cube is a nice looking computer. On this particular one,
I wonder if you could fit multiple pies in it.
Well, it does look like you must be able to fit 3 or 4. I would guess. I don't know what you would do with 3 or 4 Bitcoin.
Oh, you'd have to use some of that space for a KVM and.
Right. Yeah, on the one of the pictures that I think it was also on the Facebook group, he had posted a picture of the cube next to with a full sized regular NeXT keyboard in front of it, and the wire kind of wrapping around the back as if plugged in. It's quite an amazing picture, but I think you have to be a member of the group to see it. Anyway, so it looks like it's a neat thing. I know that he's also working on trying to get Next Step. Or OpenStep or something running on the Pi, and on this particular one on eBay, he's taken one of the little Next logo squares and stuck it to the front of it. So you have a 3D printed Raspberry Pi case painted black, with you know, sort of an additional little real Next item stuck onto it. So looks nice, but the NeXT logo is too big for the space it's in.
Yeah, a bit.
So, anyway, I expect there are more than 10 available. So I think they're being printed and painted on demand for the most part. And it is, it's £39 anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. About $55 US, which is not unreasonable.
Nope. And it's cool. And it will be interesting to see how this project progresses with the Pi Step, he's calling it, as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd love to run that on a Pi inside it, yeah.
I wonder if it seems like for some retro computing gift idea in the future, it might be nice to get a little pinwheel that spins, you know, and looks like the next, like, I don't know.
The spinning wheel, the spinning disc icon.
Yes. I don't know what to call that thing, but...
Is that like the Mac OS X Beach Ball of Death? I don't know.
Okay.
But the original one was designed to look like... It looked like a spinning optical disc was supposed to be the original design. But like with kind of a rainbowy light refraction on it, in a small amount of pixels, and that became a thing that people thought it was a beach ball, and then they turned it into a full beach ball.
I've never seen any NeXT equipment in the flesh or used it or it's one of those things I'd like to sort of play with one of these days.
Yeah, they're nice. I'm touching one now. It's right here on the desk. But
too much information.
That's right.
Okay. That's what we're here for.
So let's see. Now we can turn to eBay auctions. Jack, you have the first one.
Yeah, I found something that is kind of cool. This is not actually like a used item on eBay. This is someone selling new of these things that they're making. But it's cool. It's a PS2 mouse adapter for the Amiga and for the Atari ST. There are jumpers to switch which one you use it on. I, in the past, have owned both an Atari ST and an Amiga. And one of the worst things about both of those computers were the god-awful mouse that they came with, which were both just awful. Mm-hmm. But so now you can plug in a PS2 mouse, which, I mean, okay, sure, most new mice these days are USB mice, but even if in that case you can get a PS2 to USB adapter, which will probably just work. So anyway, it's only cost like 10 British pounds, which is not much money, and someone is manufacturing these, so there are plenty available. There's just a buy it now price. So if you need that, if you're still using an Amiga or an Atari ST, do yourself a favor. Throw away the horrible mouse and plug in a proper mouse.
Cool. That's all. Nice. Who's next? Michael's next.
Yes. Well, everyone seems to like to have their clickety keyboards Be they the later Macintosh ones or the IBM ones, that they love that throw on the keystroke, that they love the noise of the switches. Well, here is a real clickety keyboard for you. USB, plug it into your PC, your Mac, use it for your iPad, and trust me, no one's going to bump this one off your desk.
That is unreal. You might want to just reveal to the listeners what it is we're talking about.
Dear listeners, what we have here is a good old-fashioned typewriter, and I mean old-fashioned. We're talking steampunk here. And it's been set up to basically use it as a USB keyboard. So it looks beautifully old, and I certainly hope they don't try to paper advance that iPad that's sitting in the top of the platen.
Yeah, it says Underwood number 5, actual manual typewriter. I assume the keys are not going to come up and smash your iPad.
No, I don't think they throw quite that high, but I'd be wondering if the arms actually still work, or whether they've just connected it up. But no, it's, you know, it's one of the nicer looking typewriter conversions that I've seen. I think it's a lot to do with the selection of the Underwood number 5 as the host keyboard, but it's definitely a lovely piece of engineering.
And
only $450 Australian, which makes it a bargain for anyone overseas.
Yeah.
But shipping was probably almost just as much.
No, I think it says free local heavy pickup.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. That's
no it says, yeah.
You just got to fly to Australia to pick it up. But I would love to see a video of this thing in operation, and know if those arms actually going up and hitting something, and like, how does it work? How does it go? Like, what is attached to these moving keys that is generating signals to go out a USB cable? I just want to know. I just want to know.
I think I have seen some kits that you can use to convert typewriters. So, I think you do put some kind of like sensor array underneath the keyboard to get the signals. But it would be interesting to see it operating.
But even so, it's a nice electromechanical hookup to get it all going. And if you definitely want a conversation piece on your office desk, this one certainly will do the job.
Yeah,
I actually have an old Underwood typewriter, not quite as old as this one appears to be, but it's just sort of sitting on a shelf gathering dust. Maybe I should try and convert it.
Yeah, I used to have an old Remington typewriter. I don't remember where it disappeared to. I think one of my brothers might have ended up with it, and I think it's gone to the scrap metal merchant in the sky. But
didn't you say that they you had been encouraged not to use your Apple keyboard too at work? Seems like all right. If you want me to switch keyboards, I will do that. I'll use this one.
Yeah, I think if I drop this onto my desk, the whole building would know about it. That's not a keyboard. This is a keyboard.
That's right. Excellent.
And of course, you're going to need a mouse to go with it, and not just any mouse. So I thought, it's not quite the same vintage, but a good old Kensington Turbo Mouse. It's ADB, but I could use my Omega ADB to USB adapter, and I could have myself a good old Kensington track mouse, turbo mouse, whatever you want to call it. I actually quite enjoyed. I had one of these a while ago, it must have been borrowed. I can't find it anywhere, so I'd have to get another one. But it was interesting, and I don't think you could actually get something that would quite match the typewriter in style. But
the trackballs of the time were primitive.
Yes. Also doubled as ammunition for a cannon.
Right. But, I like trackballs. I think I never really used them, at the actual time, but I had friends who swore by them, and while I was swearing at my mice, so
Yeah, I always found them a little bit more reliable than the old mouse with the rolling ball in it. It always seemed to collect the dust and gunk on the desk, and the trackball seemed to somewhat less. But I think I still prefer the typewriter as a keyboard, but I thought I'd better put a pointing device into the selection as well.
Well, I think the trackball, and like the thing that it appeals to me now about the trackball is that, you know, with all of these computers around and like not very much desk space to devote to any one of them, the trackball is nice because you can, you know, it's a very confined area.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah.
Go anywhere.
Yeah. Being static, you can sort of like find a spot for it.
Right.
And get the cable back to the device. Yeah.
Excellent.
I once had, I was working at a company that things really went sour and I really didn't like it anymore. But I had a great trackball at this company. It was a Microsoft trackball. And as I recall, it was like the ball part was under your thumb and quite a large ball. And you had three fingers free for mouse button stuff. And to this day, my greatest regret after leaving that company is I did not take that trackball with me. I don't know what I was thinking.
You thought you might get more use from the stapler?
Yeah. This looks like it looks like a mouse with a tumor. That's really awful. Oh well.
Say that with an Arnold Schwarzenegger accent. Tumor.
Right. Okay, let's see. Actually, I don't have very much this time. Last time I remarked on the, you know, amazing fact that there was a TI-99-4, not 4A, on eBay, and, you know, talking about how they never show up and I always look for them, and there's another one this time. I'm hoping that we'll get this episode posted in time, that they'll still be running, but so it's 3 days out from when we're recording this, but there's another TI-99-4. And the same seller, it seems to be somebody who had a you know, an old TI collection, and has some other pretty interesting things as well. So there's I would say basically just look at the things that the seller has listed. But so the 99.4, let's see, just to say what's going on with that, it is currently at $52, but I expect that it will go for more. Actually, I forget what I didn't check to see what the previous one went for, but these are rare, and even if there were two in 2 weeks, I think there aren't going to be many more. But it has, so the 99.4A, or the 99.4, I guess, all had the connection, the bus connection or whatever, was on the side. So you could add the things to the side. Probably anyone who has a 99.4A has one of these speech synthesizers, because it seems to be there are twice as many of those as there are computers. It seems like, so those are similarly plug-in on the side, and the 99.4A had this big, huge peripheral expansion box that you could get for it, and that's where you would normally put the disk drives and the serial cards and stuff like that. But before there was a expansion box, everything was just done with these little, you know, more of these little sidecar things. So you plug one into the computer, and then it's got a receptacle that you can, like, you know, plug the next one into it. And so there are these hilarious pictures of I've seen a couple of them with a relatively complete 99.4 or 99.4A setup, with like the computer on the left, and then, you know, like I don't know what it is, it's like 6 feet of sidecars, you know, stuck onto the right of it. it's really just because you can get a RS-232, and you can plug in a disk controller. So that's the actual auction I'm linking to here, is a standalone disk controller thing. And then each disk drive itself can sit in that chain. And then you can have a printer and a modem, and it's really just very funny looking pictures. But I think the standalone disk controller is actually relatively rare, and I think it can control up to 3 drives. The seller also has a drive, PHP 1850, and apparently only one of them. But anyway, it's interesting to see these early TI-99.4A things. It's another platform I don't know very well, but one that I do want to know a little more about. So that's it. It's all TI for me today.
You're just in that kind of a mood. I can say that the first, I'm pretty sure the first computer I actually used was a TI-99/4A or 4 in a public library when I was 9 or 10. And I was pretty excited about it. I got to go there and they showed us how to like there were a couple of games you could plug in the cartridge slot. Like there was a football game or something. And I didn't really know what I was doing at all. And I remember then going back to the library with my mom and saying, look, we can use this. And she was kind of terrified that I was going to turn on the computer and the monitor in the wrong order and break it somehow. Mm-hmm. I was like, no, it's going to be fine. And it was fine.
Cause kids are always right about that kind of thing.
It's true. And interestingly enough, so I think that was actually probably the first and last time I ever used the TI-99/4 or 4A. Just never been a thing for me.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I think there was one friend of mine in high school who had one, but not somebody I hung out with much or whatever, because I almost never.
Because why would you?
Yeah.
You would hang out with somebody with a T, seriously.
I think it had pretty good graphics support. Actually, I think it had some kind of sprite chip in it that was relatively good. But
I'm sure it was better than Apple II graphics. But what was it?
Yeah, I forget now. There's also something about there was something that made it super extra slow. The basic, like it was double interpreted or some kind of crazy thing. But anyway, yeah. So. The 99/4A is so short that I have stuck it on a shelf and is completely unusable. I have one here waiting for me to use it at some point, but actually I have several because it's almost cheaper not to get them. They seem to just multiply, so I think I probably have three of them, but whatever. Anyway. okay, I guess that's basically about it. So now, if there are any sort of closing thoughts, Michael, did you have anything you wanted to part with?
No, I just still plodding along with my 10-line program. The difficult part is it's a text adventure, so you need to have text.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's one thing to sort of have an engine in there, but if you can't get the room descriptions, it's not much of a program then. So at the moment, I'm heavily pruning and rewriting routines to give me more space for room descriptions.
Well, cool. Good luck.
Yeah, I think I've got it down to about 13 lines at the moment. So.
And Jack, what's happening with you?
Oh,
striving toward health.
Striving towards health. Yes. Must make it to work tomorrow.
Okay. Good luck. Let's see, what have I been doing? Just recently, I was motivated to get out a speech synthesizer box that I had. There's some sort of specialized software that uses this. It was Jostin's Learning Systems Euphonic speech synthesizer. So it's kind of an unusual thing. It's not the sort of common one was the Echo 2 on the Apple II, but this was sort of a specialized one for education, and there were 4AM was going through a bunch of software for it and didn't have anyone to test it, so I got a chance to test it. And it was kind of cool, actually. It's not a bad synthesizer, so I got a chance to play with that a bit. Spent a little bit of time earlier today trying to it was like a sort of early graphics demo for the Apple II that was written by Bob Bishop called Apple Vision. I think probably nearly everybody will have seen this because it was on the System Master Disk. It draws a little, basically a little room and a little television, and there's a sign on the wall that says Home Sweet Home, and then this little guy dances to Turkey in the Straw. But so someone on the Facebook group had posted this thing, you know, like a screenshot of it, and someone else had asked me, like, what game is that? It looks familiar. And of course, it's not a game. It's basically just a demo. But I thought, yes. Maybe I can make a game out of that. So now I have this idea that I was going to... So I spent a little time writing a assembly language, sort of like game engine, that I, you know, succeed pretty much from scratch, you know, like without any sort of library behind it. And, you know, so I can move this little double line that represents part of the table around the screen with the keyboard. And it's, you know, it's all very quick in assembly language and has, you know, Y table lookups and everything. But I realized this is might be too much work for the joke, but what I wanted to do was basically have, you know, like have it turn it into a game. So you're the guy inside the screen, but I might end up using a 3D 3D engine, so like the room could tilt and the table start sliding away from under the television, and like you have to bump the TV from inside to keep it on the table without falling so it doesn't fall off. But anyway, we'll see how that works. Perhaps I will have a game to announce at some point. That's it. That's nice. That's what I've been doing. Mainly I've just had no time for anything, but so it goes.
Yep.
Okay. I have no idea how long that was. Probably longer than it should have been. But so that will be it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums that are now at www.vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. Just rolls right off the tongue. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group by searching for Retro Computing Roundtable. It's also at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network, which has a Facebook group that you can find the link for.
You're not going to read off that number, Paul?
No. It's at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review for us on iTunes. It will help other people find the show. So, with that, I guess, until next time,
Retro Compute!
/forum/forum/forum/php
That's right. It says number 9.